добрые его слова.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Obviously, we know Ma'mun had no good intention in asking the Imam to leave Medina and come to Marw. He had no good intention. A person who is so ruthless that has fought his own brother for governance and killed him. He ordered to kill his own brother. Not for any good reason, again. It wasn't that his brother was a tyrant and his brother committed crimes that he needed to be brought to justice. The crimes of his brother compared to the crimes of Ma'mun are negligible, one can say. The crimes of Ma'mun are much greater. Person who's that bad, asking the Imam to come to Marw is obviously not going to be a good reason. Presenting him after arrival, upon arrival, presenting him with khilafah cannot be genuine and cannot be a real request for the Imam to take on the leadership and the government and ruling over a Muslimun after such a long gap of the leadership or the rule of the Imams over the Muslim community. That could not have been genuine. A side little point here that I want to mention. Again, I hope I don't take too much time on this, but as I was saying this, as clear as it is to all of us that he was not genuine, when we see things like that happening around us, for some reason we don't treat them the way we treat this offer to the Imam. When we see a tyrant, when you see the U.S. government offering something that seems to be good, we don't seem to be judging them the way we judge Ma'mun, whereas they're much worse than Ma'mun was. If they offer anything that looks good, they cannot have any good intention behind it. If they offer you something that looks good, it must be more evil than the wrong that they have done. And you have to treat it and deal with it the way Imam Ar-Ridha salamullah alayhi dealt with it. And that is absolutely not. Thank you, you can keep your khilafah to yourself. I don't need you to give me a khilafah. As the Imam told him, if khilafah is yours, you have no right to give it to me. And if it's not yours, you have no right to give it to me. Now, the response of the Imam is that this is the power of the intelligence and the ability to respond from the strength of Tawheed, the strength that the Imam has. He's been brought by this tyrant and is in an environment he's being forced to accept this. The Imam's response is this, if it's yours, to the Khalifa himself. The world is afraid. This is the superpower of the time. Don't forget, the Abbasid Empire at the time is greater than the Roman Empire, whatever they say about the Roman Empire. The Abbasid Empire was greater than the Roman Empire. The Romans were afraid of the Abbasid Empire. If you didn't know that, go read your history. Don't underestimate or underread and misunderstand the conditions. All these empires that were there, the Abbasid Empire is not an Islamic empire, therefore it's not a good empire. But compared to the others, it's much better because it has some traces of Islam in ways. Anyhow, the point is, the whole world is afraid of this emperor. This is the emperor of the time. In the East and the West, there is no empire greater than the Muslim empire. And the ruler is Ma'mun. In a room where Ma'mun is, and the Imam is being forced, the Imam says, if it's yours, you have no right to give it to me. And if it's not yours, you have no right to give it to me. And the language is not even, he doesn't even soften the tone of his approach. This is how you should deal with that. That's a side point. That's not the main point here. Let's not get distracted by that. So clearly it's not an intention that can be classified as good. So let's analyze. Why would Ma'mun want to do this? Ayatollah Khamenei has a very interesting analysis that I'll try to present in the brief time that I have in terms of what they were trying to do in general, and then you can get the idea of we can start deducing why these sessions were set up, these debates were. And then if you see that Ma'mun continued this after Imam al-Ridha with his son, Imam al-Jawad, trying a failed attempt again with the son, in a certain way, I'll try to briefly touch that. Ma'mun considered himself to be more intelligent than all his predecessors. He thought he was he outsmarted a lot of people too, in terms of his dirty politics. Fadl ibn Sahl, which was his right hand, thought he was so smart. He had planned so many different things. Some say he even planned to use Ma'mun to become the Khalifa and get rid of Ma'mun. But Ma'mun outsmarted Fadl ibn Sahl. And he outsmarted all of those who in Baghdad were surrounding and helping with their guidance, his brother Amin. He outsmarted all of those. He considered himself a very intelligent person. And he was taught as a child. He knew a lot of different things. And unfortunately, this is what happens when a person who is not trained, a person who does not have taqwa, has more knowledge, they will do more wrong. So he realized that his predecessors were ineffective and incapable with dealing with the problem of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt and their followers. The Umayyads had their problems with the Ahlul Bayt and their followers. And the Abbasids had their problem with the Umayyads. In other words, their version of the problem. They all had a problem because the Imams considered themselves to be the qualified and justified and the real and true rulers of Islam and Muslimin. They considered themselves such, rightfully so. And they didn't accept the Khulafa, whether it's the Umayyads or the Abbasids, as the legitimate rulers. They didn't believe in that. They didn't simply keep that faith to themselves, keep that understanding to themselves. They had a movement. They led a movement. The Abbasids knew this very closely because they were able to hijack the movement that the Ahlul Bayt had created. They became the rulers of the land because of the call of the masses towards the government of the Ahlul Bayt. So they knew what power that has. And if the people are able to have a stronger and closer connection, if we allow these imams to do what they want, they will overthrow us, they will establish their government. This was something that was very evident and clear to the Abbasids. They knew this very closely, as I said, because they hijacked that movement. But he saw that as much as his father Harun tried to get rid of the problem still existed. Imam al-Kadhim was taken out, but the movement remained. And now the head of that movement is Imam al-Ridha. What do we do with this? For all this time, for centuries now, this leader is taken out, another leader leads the same movement, the same problem exists, and the movement gets stronger. That's what he is seeing. In fact, Ma'mun is seeing that during the period that Ma'mun and Amin were fighting each other for governance, Imam al-Ridha is busy with work, and he realizes, and people tell him, at this point, the followers and the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, meaning followers are one set of people, that's one category of people, those who align themselves with the Ahlul Bayt, not necessarily viewing them as imams the way a proper Shia does, but in terms of seeing the Ahlul Bayt and seeing these other rulers, they align with the Ahlul Bayt. They are referred to as Alawiyun. The reason for that is that these are both factions of the Hashimiyun, or the Hashimites, the Abbasids and the Alawis. The distinction is that these are Abbasids, those are Alawids, or Abbasiyun and Alawiyun. Alawiyun, people who align themselves with that, the numbers have increased in the various areas, especially areas between these two, the mountains and the Jibal, between Baghdad and Marw, Kurdistan of Iraq and Iran, that region of Kurdistan. That area was filled with the various cities, not necessarily only the Kurdish region where that ethnicity is, although that area is included, but also further north and further south of that. These Jibal were known to have lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. These are the Alawiyun. This is an area between Ma'mun and Amin. They should have more control over this region. And you see that it's filled with those who love the Ahlul Bayt, the true Ahlul Bayt, the Alawi side of the family of the Prophet, against the Abbasid side.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyum
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
آیت‌الله حسنزاده آملی رو ایشون خودشون من از زبان خودشون دارم عرض میکنم خدمتتون میفرمودن که وقتی بعد
Once Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali, the famous Iranian Shiite scholar and mystic, may Allah protect him, told me a story about himself. He said, once after my classes were done, when I was taking a short nap during the noon, the children were playing in the yard and were making lots of noise. I got a little bit angry and criticized them for the noise. Then I decided to continue my rest. However, I found that I cannot rest because I was not happy at all with my own behavior towards the children in the yard. I decided to leave the village in which I was living for a while and go and visit one of my spiritual trainers. From Amul, I traveled to Tehran, and from there I went to Tabriz. I went to the house of my teacher, the late Ayatollah Elahi Tabatabai, the brother of the late Allama Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. Ayatollah Elahi Tabatabai was a great mystic and the teacher of his time. When I got to his house, he asked me about the reason for my stay in Tabriz. Because I was supposed to be in Amul now and have my teaching courses over there.
هنوز داشت به تعارفات اولیه میگذشت و ایشون میخواست برای من چایی بیاره و خوش آمدی و هنوز به این چیزا داشت میگذشت.
When Ayatollah Elahi Tabatabai was serving me with tea, suddenly he told me, by the way, the late Ayatollah Ghazi was not happy with you. He told me in my dream that if you want to understand the presence of Imam al-Mahdi, you must be more careful with your behavior. I was shocked and embarrassed by this sentence of my master Ayatollah Elahi Tabatabai and understood that the great men of Allah can witness our behavior by the grace of Allah. Then I told my teacher and master, the late Ayatollah Elahi Tabatabai, the reason I am here is because I broke the hearts of some children at my house when they were playing and I was not happy with their noise. From this story, which is narrated by Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amali, we understand that many of our problems or spiritual shortcomings are rooted in our own behaviors and deeds in this world. In other words, many of our spiritual imperfections are caused by our carelessness about trivial points inside our house.
به خاطر همین چیزایی که تو خونه آدم رعایت نمی‌کنه، همین چیزای کوچیک کوچیک.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page, We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm Kavit Atwaye. In today's program, we're going to take a look at crypto world, in particular Bitcoin. Why are central banks so worried about cryptocurrency as a whole? Some of the highlights of today's program: what is Bitcoin? We're going to define that for you. What is cryptocurrency? What is blockchain? And you hear about mining. What is that? What actually determines the worth of cryptocurrency? And what is the big deal anyways? Is it worth the investment? Also, we'll take a look at governments in particular and their central banks. They want you to believe that everything is cool, that they're still under control. But are they scrambling to play catch-up, or are they trying to see how they can maybe control it, or maybe they're just looking for ways to undermine it, like the U.S. Fed or the European Central Bank? Then we're going to take a look at crypto listing, like Coinbase. It got listed at NASDAQ. Also, Bitcoin got listed a few years back, not the coin itself, but then they're dangerous because the Dow took a correction. So pretty much a risky bet, wouldn't you say? Elon Musk had some killer tweets that led to the crash. However, he then focused on Dogecoin. Is that his new bet now?
Cryptocurrencies took a big hit recently. A massive crash in cryptocurrency prices wiped out $1 trillion of wealth. Bitcoin, the biggest and most popular cryptocurrency, plunged 50% to its lowest level since January, hitting a low of nearly $30,000. Meanwhile, other popular digital currencies tanked as well. Ether and Dogecoin both declined by 25 to 30% as well. The swing in the cryptocurrency market came after China reportedly banned banks from cryptocurrency business. The U.S. also announced a crackdown by the Department of Justice and the IRS, expressing concerns that cryptocurrencies are being used to conceal illegal transactions.
We will not allow digital asset service providers to operate in the shadows and will not tolerate the use of the cryptocurrencies in support of illicit activities.
One sign that cryptocurrencies are giving real money a run for the money, so to speak, is that they are actually being listed in the stock markets. Now take the listing of San Francisco-based Coinbase. Coinbase became one of the biggest U.S. cryptocurrency exchanges. The owner recalls his early days.
Yes, it's scary because it's new and there are new security concerns that need to be addressed with it, but that's sort of where I see Coinbase coming in. It's the sort of consumer-friendly front.
So Coinbase is the NASDAQ for cryptocurrencies. And what you have to think about is, you know, there's tons of cryptocurrencies. And the question is, like, how do you trade against that? And that's what Coinbase does. And they did a lot of business. They did $1.8 billion worth in Q1 alone.
They have almost 56 million users, only 4 million of them active, monthly activities. So 4 million, about 7% of them, they are really making these kind of activities on the exchange. 56% of the trades of the $335 billion is done with two types of cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Now you hear Bitcoin there. Well, Bitcoin also made its debut on a major stock exchange back in the year 2017. Well, the coin itself did not make its debut. It was introduced as a futures contract. A futures contract is a financial product that allows investors to bet on whether the currency's price will rise or fall. Now, at that time, Bitcoin opened at $15,000 per unit at the Chicago Board Options Exchange.
So we here at Cboe view cryptocurrencies as a new asset class, and as such, we think that it's ready for derivatives, and that's why we've chosen to list futures on Bitcoin. We think that it brings some needed regulation to the Bitcoin marketplace, and it gives people who have concerns around custody of Bitcoin or the process of opening wallets, gives them access to Bitcoin in a more traditional form.
Okay, it's time to ask a fundamental question here. That question is, what is the purpose of digital currency? That is a simple enough question, isn't it? In this segment, we have a Q&A with Miguel Francis Santiago. He's the founder and CEO of the Future Is Now Media Group. Miguel, welcome to the program. We are looking at the notion of cryptocurrencies and digital money, which is still foreign to some, just like the beginning days of internet. So if you can please explain the technology to us, how it operates, especially when it comes, its, I guess, comparison when it's being made to real money.
Well, it operates by creating an alternative store of value and also a store of transactions where you do not have to resort to a centralized banking system to help you get that done, either to store your value, your money, or to transact with your value, your money. By having a decentralized ledger technology as the underlying building block of it, composed of many nodes all over the world, to enable the system to work. That is why it takes time for the hash to go through the system and for the money to transact, and that is why sometimes when the system is overloaded, although we are in the inception ages, I mean, we're literally taking baby steps right now, even though Bitcoin has, you know, surpassed the all-time high of 20K, and we saw the all-time high of 63K this year, as compared to its previous bull run in 2018, we're still in baby steps.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it, Miguel. All right, we're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up. Stay right where you are. But before we go for the break, here's one family that has taken the crypto craze to a whole new level. They abandoned the traditional way of life, whether it's work or their kids' schooling, to live a crypto lifestyle.
Yeah, we live solely on Bitcoin as much as possible, and we've tried to live on places in places where, like, the Bitcoin is accepted a little bit more. So, like, where there is a restaurant and a hotel that accept Bitcoin, it's more easy for us.
We don't need to go to school, and we don't need to stand up at 8 o'clock in the morning.
It's time for an in-depth section. Let's take a look at Bitcoin when it started out. Essentially, when it did, it was in the year 2009, and it was worth 0.008 cents of a dollar. Imagine that. And then it went to 8 cents per dollar, which shot up 900%. Then in February of 2011, it hit parity with the dollar, which meant that it was worth $1, and has not looked back since. It peaked at $19,783 in December of 2017. Now, the current price, as of May 29, it stands at roughly around, you're going to see that in a second, $36,000, May of 2021. And it has been extremely volatile after the crash. There was a crash. Take a look at the price when it hit the high. It was $61,783. Now, just think if you had purchased one back when it was just 8 cents or even less, just imagine how much profits you would have made. Well, now comes the functioning part of cryptocurrencies, how they work. By now, you might have read up on it, but here are the facts for those who either don't understand it or are just plain in the dark about it. Okay. As we know, Bitcoin is an online currency. As I mentioned, it's created from computer codes, and it has been in circulation since 2009. The identity of its creator remains a mystery. It has no connection to a central bank and is not backed by any government. Instead, its community of users control and regulate it via what's called the blockchain. Basically, it's a mathematical process to provide anonymous and secure transfers.
So Bitcoin is a decentralized cryptocurrency. It's purely internet-based. that's part of the appeal to a lot of people because it's decentralized, it's not controlled by any central government, and it can be traded, you know, across currencies in the same way that the fiat currencies can.
Okay, to get started, you create what's called a Bitcoin. You have to actually create that. It generates an address, which is unique to each transaction, which can then be used to buy goods and services or other currencies. As each transaction then becomes validated by members of the community, and that's done by tracing the origin of each Bitcoin using special software. This is what's called mining. Now, to make sure that no single Bitcoin can be spent in more than one place simultaneously, which is one of the most important things about Bitcoin and currencies, digital currencies. Now, the fastest to do so are issued with new Bitcoins, and as a result, they're rewarded for their efforts. Now, let's move on to the question here. Does Bitcoin use too much energy? Well, mining requires enormous processing power. I mean, you wouldn't believe how much power it takes. You have powerful computers who are consuming huge amounts of electricity, some as much as a country. It is estimated that in 2021, Bitcoin's annual consumption could actually climb to 128 terawatts, terawatt hours, that is. That's 0.6% of world electricity production, or 10 times more than Google, if you can believe that. Now, there are giant data centers or huge mining factories. In terms of their location, you're looking at China, 65% of them, 6.9% in Russia, and then in the U.S., 7.2%. Now, critics like China and even Tesla's Elon Musk point to the environmental impact that the electricity generates through mining regions, which contributes to things like climate change. Well, let's bring in Keith Pilbeam for this segment. He's a professor of international economics and finance at City University in London. Maybe he can shed more light on this topic. Keith, welcome. When we take a look at Bitcoin in terms of what it does, digital currencies as a whole, Bitcoin to be one of them, it is said that it's the future. It's the way that perhaps dollar is going to be replaced, and of course it's going to be used for transactions, but the key appeal being that central governments, and in particular central banks, don't control them. What are your thoughts on that, and do you agree with the future of Bitcoin in terms of its efficiency?
Well, I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding here. Bitcoin is not going to become a global currency, all right, in the same way that the US dollar. There's no chance of that happening. The US authorities, of course, central banks, may produce their own digital currencies that are counterparts to their national currencies. But as I say, Bitcoin can be traded amongst those that want to trade it, but most people don't accept it.
All right, Keith there and his take on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Our next focus, billionaire Elon Musk. You either love him or hate him, depending on whether he was a reason for you to make money or lose money, as was the case with some of his tweets, which caused crypto mayhem and a crypto crash.
He may be a bit odd. Quirky, perhaps. No mistake, he's a genius by some standards for his accomplishments. After all, you don't become the world's richest man worth billions of dollars by accident. And he must wield some power if one tweet can send the price of a crypto coin skyrocket or crash, as was the case with Bitcoin. This is a tweet that sent the price of Bitcoin crashing. He also then said that cryptocurrencies cannot come as a cost to the environment.
Musk has been one of the cheerleaders, the biggest proponents of Bitcoin, and for 3 months later, for him to start to cite environmental issues, which have not changed in the last 3 months, it's something where this U-turn is definitely not being taken well by investors in the crypto market.
His car company Tesla revealed in February it had bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. The company later said it had trimmed its position by 10% in the first quarter. Now, his love affair is with Dogecoin. He called Dogecoin the people's crypto. But a market that can sink based on a person's tweet? This is a classic case of extreme volatility, which prevents cryptocurrency growth while detracting investors.
Elon had a very short affair with Bitcoin. I guess he didn't realize who he married. You know, I know that Tesla stands for green cars and electric cars and so on, but those cars consume exactly the same electricity that Bitcoin consumes. So I think it was a premature divorce.
Maybe it's better that you pay attention to his own recommendation, which he tweeted here.
Hello, welcome to the Info News section. Now, the first item that we're going to take a look at, which caught our attention from this past week, was from right here in Iran. In terms of what has happened, well, in regards to energy, Iran has banned crypto mining. Now, you may ask, obviously, why Iran decided to do that. Well, unfortunately, what has happened is that because of crypto mining, you've had electricity outages and shortages that happened not only in the capital, but around the country. That's how much energy crypto mining actually uses. And in terms of the world, 4.5% of all Bitcoin mining takes place in Iran, 4.5%. So that gives you an idea as to how much crypto mining occurs right here in the Islamic Republic. Next up, Total demo. Not a total demo, Total, as in the oil or petroleum company. It's been accused of ecocide, human rights violations, and also greenwashing. Why? Well, fossil fuel projects in Uganda is the reason. It has actually affected 178 villages there in Uganda. So again, you have an oil company that's being accused of things like you know, climate change or factors that affect or contribute to climate change. This particular item is very interesting. Declining population is something that needs to be looked at. Fewer babies cries, more abandoned homes, and deaths exceed births. That's actually taken from a headline on this. Basically, we're looking at a declining population because countries are confronting what's called population stagnation and a fertility bust. So you're having a decrease in population, which could lead to complication in a wide variety of arenas. This may be a topic for our future program. And finally, enough of capitalism. Yeah, we've heard that before, but obviously it's very hard to follow. Why? Endless economic growth is not good. Now, why would that not be good? The reasons are many, as you're about to see over here. Extraction, production, and consumption, that can be harmful. It can affect the environment. You have plastic bags that carry shopping bags that carry goods, etc. These all affect the human life in one way or another. So those were some of the top stories. We always like to hear from you. If you want to contribute to a topic to the program, do send it to us to our email address, the old-fashioned way. We'd love to hear from you. Now, decentralization is one thing, evading central government's banking system so that they can't control how we spend our money. But when an entire country is placed under sanctions, especially a central bank, that is a totally different story. Countries under heavy U.S. sanctions have taken matters into their own hands, the crypto way. Okay, let me bring back Keith Pilbeam for this segment. Keith, many sanction-hit countries like Venezuela, Russia, and of course Iran, they have welcomed the use of cryptocurrencies in order to evade the illegal U.S. sanctions. China has developed its own digital yuan. Are we looking at the dollar being replaced at some point due to the rise of these cryptocurrencies?
There's no danger of the U.S. dollar being replaced by digital currencies. There will be a digital dollar, I've got no doubt about that, over time, and that will complement the existing dollar, as there will be eventually, you know, a digital euro and probably a digital pound. But these will just be equivalent to the national currencies, and there needs to be very careful monitoring and mechanisms, but they will be widely accepted as a use of payment, okay? Now, lots of people are thinking that these coins are going to replace currencies. They're not. They may complement. Some people will have good use, and they can be used, but don't forget, over time, it's getting easier to transfer money at very low rates, and it's not so cheap. If you want to transfer money in Bitcoin, there are various fees, and there's an awful lot of risk, all right? A lot of people don't realize that at any moment, if you don't hold your money in a what they call a cold wallet, and it's held on an exchange, your account could be blocked. The exchange might just block it. So people have to be very careful in the way they're managing these their money.
Let's find out what Miguel Francis Santiago thinks, the founder and CEO of the Future Is Now Media Group. Miguel, welcome back Do you agree with what Keith said in terms of the crypto and the dollar? I mean, first of all, when it comes to the countries like Venezuela, Russia, and Iran, they're replacing or they're going with crypto, and they've welcomed it in order to evade the illegal U.S. sanctions. But will cryptocurrencies overall lead eventually to the replacement of the dollar from transactions, do you think?
Well, we're getting the U.S. digital dollar. I mean, we are going to see the dollar replaced, but it's not going to be replaced in the modern sense by anything better than what is already there. If a centralized government authority is giving me a monetary system of exchange that's based on the blockchain, I'm not going to take that. I feel that that is absolutely, it's ludicrous to think that this is even, it has nothing to do with cryptocurrencies. I mean, these are centralized tools of control being perpetuated by central governments like digital dollar, digital yuan, and sure, they will, digital euro, they will probably replace the reserve paper dollar, but the whole point in that is only because the, I'll just say, the status quo is getting rid of paper money. That's the only reason that that's happening, because all of a sudden, you can now have this whole la-la land fabricated bubble system of government bonds on, instead of on paper, on a digital blockchain trackable ledger. And that is not good for the masses. That is not good for the people. If anything, that's very good for a COVID passport and potentially using that technology to be stored on your COVID passport, if it may be a digital card or a digital chip, whatever, then that supposedly will, you know, be sold to you as a way to cut through the layer of governments, to cut through the bureaucracy under the guise of innovation. But in reality, that's you giving up your freedom ultimately to a government blockchain.
From Russia to Venezuela to China and to Iran, cryptocurrencies have an appeal. The main reason? To evade U.S. sanctions.
My sense of cryptocurrencies largely driven to evade U.S. sanctions and to undermine sovereign currencies. Both of them are a challenge to the national interests of the United States.
We need to search for unconventional solutions. These are the people who will build our new future and live there.
Let's not forget, they are illegal, hence the appeal. Each country uses it to get around the sanctions. But there is another hope behind using the cryptocurrencies, to replace the U.S. dollar as the common currency. China has adopted its own digital currency called the digital yuan. It is already being used on a wide scale. Only time will tell whether that can eliminate the dollar along with other digital currencies.
Digital currencies like Bitcoin or Dogecoin or many others, they are here to stay. There is no doubt about that. You've heard our guests. Now, whether that is a good thing or not, well, that is the question. Let's look at this from another angle. For example, pretend if you were a Syrian or an Iraqi and your country was getting bombed. Obviously, you wouldn't like that. Well, central governments control the money supply, money to wage wars. That is a fact. Hence, the appeal of cryptocurrencies. Now, the downside, there are laws that citizens are breaking, like the ones who are kidnapping or drug lords, for example, or tax evaders. They love cryptocurrencies. Did I say tax evaders? Well, consider this. Tax evasion remains a problem to this day, and countries committing the most tax evasions, the ones holding the biggest central banks, they're the ones, like in the U.S. and in the U.K., for example. Well, all that I have said really is nothing new. But what will be new is when crypto usage becomes so mainstream that it leaves central governments without the power that they once had, the power that controlled our lives one way or another. And that could affect their decision in terms of policies, which requires capital from foreign policy to you name it. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was a pleasure to have you. Until next time, I'm covered that way. It's goodbye.
the limelight.
Dr. Seyed Ebrahim Raisi's victory is the triumph of the real aspirations of the Iranian people in ensuring the country's independence, peace, stability, and its march towards the peaks of progress, along with the iron resolve to continue efforts to develop nuclear energy, improve deterrent missile technology, and having an active presence in the countries of the region and beyond in order to save them from terrorism and American hegemony. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading, The Right Man to Head the Presidency. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The spectacular victory of the Iranian people in the 13th presidential polls of the Islamic Republic has brought to power a familiar face, with an unblemished record of service to the nation, much to the horror of the enemies of humanity, especially the U.S. This is clear by the loud moaning of the media horns in North America and West Europe, where leaders of the regimes with deep animosity towards Islam and the Iranian people know for sure that Ayatollah Sayyid Ebrahim Raisistanati, popularly known as Raisi, is serious about ending American terrorism, whether political or economic, in this part of the world. The Iranian electorate thus made the right decision to give a massive mandate as the country's new president to the man who, for the past 2 years as head of the judiciary, has successfully resolved many outstanding issues preceded by his decades-long experiences in various judicial institutions with focus on the rule of law, social justice, and development of national industries. The nation is now looking forward to President Raisi, who after 45 days will officially take charge of the country's executive efforts to start endeavors on improving the economic conditions of the people with emphasis upon economy of resistance, as stressed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader was thus absolutely right in his recent message in hailing the Iranian people as the great winners of the June 18th elections, which he called an epic turnout at a time when the COVID-19 pandemic is widespread and many families unwilling to take the risk of venturing out of their houses. Under such circumstances, the fact that almost 50% of the eligible voters braved coronavirus in this year's scorching summer heat to cast their votes at the ballot boxes throughout the country was indeed a courageous step and proof of the faith of the masses in the dynamic Islamic Republic system. Another important point to note is that Raisi's clear-cut victory, judging from the 18 million votes, or almost 70% of the ballot papers counted, in addition to the support he enjoys from millions more whose natural fears of coronavirus prevented them from coming out of their houses to vote, is without the least doubt the triumph of a transcendental figure popular among people of all walks of life, rather than a factional figure. The composition of the cabinet is of vital importance, since the persons chosen to head the various ministries undo approval of their revolutionary and related credentials by majority vote in the parliament should have the same commitment as the president to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the iron resolve to end U.S. meddling in our part of the world. To sum up, Raisi's victory is the triumph of the real aspirations of the Iranian people in ensuring the country's independence, peace, stability, and its march towards the peaks of progress, along with the iron resolve to continue efforts to develop nuclear energy, improve deterrent missile technology, and having an active presence in the countries of the region and beyond in order to save them from terrorism and American hegemony.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Relations between the United States and Russia came under the spotlight this week as presidents of the two geopolitical rivals sat down for talks in Geneva. Before the meeting, Washington and Moscow had acknowledged that relations were at rock bottom. A series of tit-for-tat actions, which escalated in recent years, has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Moscow and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. The depth of differences between the two sides had dashed hopes of any breakthrough during the meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The Geneva talks lasted around 3 hours. The two presidents did not even come close to resolving any of the acrimonious conflicts that have sent U.S.-Russian ties to their lowest level in decades. However, Biden and Putin agreed to launch a dialogue on atomic arms control. They also said that they would return ambassadors to Washington and Moscow to ease diplomatic contacts. The ambassadors were withdrawn in March for consultations after Washington accused Moscow of interference in America's 2020 presidential election. That is a claim that Moscow vehemently denies. The agreements in Geneva this week have somehow reduced bilateral tensions for now, but it is definitely too early to know whether the two rivals will eventually engage in meaningful cooperation. The presidents of the U.S. and Russia hailed their dialogue in Geneva. The Russian president said Biden was an experienced statesman. But despite the pleasantries, deep differences persisted in the meeting and after that. there was almost no sign of agreement on issues like cybersecurity and Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Putin warned the U.S. against imposing new sanctions on Russia. Putin and Biden also clashed over human rights issues, with the American leader threatening devastating consequences for Moscow if Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who is now serving a 2.5-year sentence, died in jail.
As we know, Washington loves to throw human rights violation allegations against everyone, which is now extremely ironic because the current official president of the United States and many Democrats around him acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has legitimate gripes with the United States. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that claims that the United States grossly violates the human rights of its own citizens.
Putin dismissed U.S. concerns about Navalny, telling Biden that the opposition leader had ignored the law. The Russian president also criticized the status of human rights in America. Putin specifically named the Black Lives Matter movement and the January 6th attack on Capitol as two cases that show the U.S. has its own grave human rights-related problems. Observers believe it is too soon to judge the outcome of the Geneva meeting. Can the two rivals somehow build on their recent meeting, bridge their differences, and hammer out compromises in the future?
If you look back to the 1990s, after the triumph in the Cold War, the United States sat down, well, certain important elites sat down and wrote the Project for a New American Century. And one of the absolute and most key points of that project, to make the century completely American, is to not allow a new competitor to rise. And when you have this sort of zero-sum game, 0-1, you know, win or lose sort of scenario, there's really no way to find any sort of true compromise or make any sort of friendly deal of any sort of meaning.
Bilateral talks on strategic arms limitations could start in a matter of weeks. The talks could serve as a test of the two sides' political will to engage in meaningful diplomacy and cooperation.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Coviran Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Farmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Sattar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute